guest each week for a long feature interview. What you're going to hear next is Canada Land Shortcuts, a topical news show where I'm joined by a different co-host each week, and we talk about the media's coverage of various stories in the news right now. Wait for it. I'm Jesse Brown, and today we are talking about the news. We'll talk about why it is getting harder for journalists to protect their sources. We'll talk about the brain gain. These are professional brainiac Doge Dodgers relocating here from the U.S. But mostly today, we'll talk about Mark Carney's first real fumble. And the country he doesn't seem to much want to talk about.
Was that a sweetheart loan? Are you beholden to China?
Absolutely not.
Wait for that. Sandy Garasino of the National Observer and podcast host. Welcome back to the show.
Great to be here, Jesse.
Mark Carney defending his decision to keep a candidate in the race while facing mounting calls to kick him out.
In January, Chang told a Chinese language media news conference that people could cash in if they turned Zhou Tei into the Chinese consulate in Toronto.
After Chang apologized, Carney decided he should remain in the race.
I view this as a teachable moment.
Now says he will not be running for re-election. He is dropping out after the backlash to comments he made.
Given that Mr. Carney still owns massive financial interests in Brookfield, which owes $250 million to a Chinese state-controlled bank.
So the story has evolved from Carney sticking by this candidate, Paul Chang, a former cop, who said that his opponent, Zhou Tei, should be handed over to Beijing authorities, I guess through these like illegal
police stations. Yeah.
Take my opponent to one of these illegal police stations that Beijing has installed in Canada in complete disrespect to our sovereignty, that have been like really plaguing Chinese Canadians, and Chinese Canadians have been asking for support for years. And this guy says, my opponent, you know, I don't know, a joke or what, but like take him in and collect the bounty that Beijing has placed.
Collect the bounty. Yeah. A lot of information in there.
This is dramatic stuff. Canadian politics is not boring. First, Chang apologizes. I shouldn't have said that stuff. It was deplorable. I stand shoulder to shoulder with all of you Hong Kong freedom fighters, he says. And Carney says, oh, I think he's learned his lesson. Carney says, this is a pardonable offense.
I will go back to the character of the individual who made a lapse start. This is someone who has served our community, has been on the front line of policing for almost three decades, and has been standing up for those rights and has that track record for it. He's made his apology. He made it to the public. He made it to the individual concerned, made it directly to me, and he's going to continue with his candidacy. Thank you.
And the media, I think, takes a very firm stance. There were editorial board missives from the Toronto Star, Globe and Mail, Robin Urbeck wrote, like, basically there was a consensus that, like, no, dude, no, that you cannot run a candidate who said this. I thought it was just a matter of time before Carney reversed himself. But then late Monday night, Chang did it to himself. He said that he doesn't want to be a distraction, and he's stepping out of the race. What did you make of this sordid little episode?
I have a question, because this is something that has only just occurred to me. Do we know when Chang made this statement about Tei?
Yeah, it was back in January in a interview, Chinese language interview. So this is one of those things that, like, it's an interesting thing doing this kind of media analysis in this fractured media environment, because we're increasingly seeing things like, you know, the Danielle Smith call with Breitbart, where it takes a couple of weeks. Like, things are getting said in little pockets, and it takes a while.
Or do they just get flagged and brought back up right in the middle of an election campaign?
Maybe.
Because it serves somebody's interests. I mean, I think it's pretty clear. Do they still call them bozo eruptions? That these things would happen and they would suddenly become front page news, not when they happened, but months later or a year later or something. So obvious real flub by Carney, and actually kind of a disturbing one in the sense that I feel like his brand, this is not somebody who's a practiced politician. We don't see him at ease at the podium and fielding these questions. There is still a brittleness to him. But there has also been something else that has seemed to come through that I think that Canadians have been taking a cotton to, which is there's kind of a seriousness. I think there's a sense that this is a real seasoned leader. He may not be a politician, but he is accomplished and at ease in the role of leadership. And you see that with his comments about Donald Trump and his kind of very measured approach. I would have expected a similar with this, and it just seemed soft. I don't see it, as Polyev is suggesting, as some kind of sop to China, but it was a real miss, and especially on a day when he just wanted to make an announcement, or he was making an announcement that the federal government was going to be getting into the business of housing and building 500,000 homes for Canadians. But that wasn't the story. The story was that he failed to oust this candidate. And I also don't think that the candidate eventually saw the light. I think that the overwhelming and massive backlash from all directions, and I would include in that probably highly placed liberals and experienced liberal campaign operatives who are not part of the campaign, but feedback going into the campaign. I think that this is a universal failing grade, and it can't make it to the next news cycle. That resignation had to be in by midnight, which it was.
I'm going to disagree with you a little bit here. I think you're onto something with like the particular way that this reflects poorly on Carney. It hits him where he lives, in that live by the sword, die by the sword. He's benefited by the fact that, unlike Polyev, who we have decades of vetting, like decades of public scrutiny, decades of decisions, decades of stupid things he said, we have to learn who Carney is in a very short. We haven't seen his judgment at play. We're told he's got a great resume. We're told in these other venues of economics, he's done great things. But in this venue, he's really benefited from, like, well, he looks like a guy who'd have good judgment. He looks like a guy who would be principled and like a dad who would, you know, make the tough call, but the right call. And you don't want to extrapolate too much from like the first time we've had to see him make a tough call, but we don't have a lot else to go on.
Well, I don't think that you can, for instance, guide the Bank of England through Brexit and take the steps, including the public steps that he took and the measures that he took, and have it say, well, we don't know if he has good judgment. And he guided the Bank of Canada through the global financial crisis, and he was there. We didn't necessarily see it close up, but I don't think you could say, well, it's only hearsay that he's got good judgment. We've never seen
it. Political judgment. Like, he's yes. Our prime minister, yeah. Right? I think we are all watching our prime minister to see if in this job, and, you know, there's people who will say otherwise about his experience with Brexit.
The Conservatives who supported Brexit will say other things about his opposition to
Brexit.
Well,
not just that, but another episode maybe, but this was the wrong call. I agree with you there that it contradicts the image that he's been writing so positively. Does this have any further bearing? I'm with you on like this whole thing about Brookfield's debt to China feels like a real reach.
Was that a sweetheart loan? Are you beholden to China?
Absolutely not.
But I'm not so sure that the wider context with China is separate from this story.
No, I agree with that.
Okay, so let's get into that, because one of the things that I think that the next Prime Minister of Canada has to deal with is the reality of foreign interference in this country. China just killed 4 Canadians. Right?
Ottawa says it strongly condemns the execution of multiple Canadians in China earlier this year over what Beijing says were drug-related crimes.
Like, we have issues with this country, and one thing that the last government was guilty of was a smugness and a constant certainty that other people were overreacting to things like foreign interference. They knew better.
Canadians can know that the integrity of our elections was not compromised.
And when Carney gets up there and says, well, I'm going to keep him around. Here's the direct quote.
I view this as a teachable moment.
That really feels like a Justin Trudeau. Like, you are not getting this right. You are not taking this seriously enough. And you are placing your own sense of reality above like actual reality here. And that's another ballot question. What is this guy's relationship with China? Like, everything, like, oh, it's all about Trump. Who's going to stand up to Trump? I don't know that there's that much to be done with Trump. We'll find out. We have to come to some new trade agreement. But then there's years of governance ahead beyond that. And China plays a big role in that. After the break, we will talk more about why Canada's future includes China, whether we like it or not. You are hosting a show that has a lot to do with China in the New World Order. And I'm curious, when you said, yes, there is a wider relevance, what came to mind for you?
There will be no ignoring China in the future for Canada. There are three major trading blocks in the world: COSMA, the USMCA, the European trading block, and then there is an Asian trading block. These are the largest trading blocks in the world. There is no ignoring them, especially those of us who live in urban centers. We want to see Canada as a manufacturing center, as a vibrant sort of urban hub, services, professional services, but we are a resource superpower. There's no question about it. And I think we have underplayed that, whether it's fertilizer, potash, which is massive, massive resource that Canada has, whether it's oil and gas, which will be a continuing pillar of our economy for decades to come, or natural gas, or minerals and mining. This is a huge asset and wealth of this nation, and one of the largest buyers on the planet is China. It's impossible for us to ignore it. At the same time, they are going to try and interfere in our elections. They try and do this everywhere in the world. They don't make a point of like really picking on Canada. They are active everywhere, as is Russia, as is India, and by the way, as is the United States. So navigating these waters is going to be very, very treacherous. There's no ignoring them. We're going to have to deal with them. The incoming prime minister is going to have to deal with them and cannot take a pugilistic stance with them, but must hold them at a distance and must be able to both deal with them and resist them and oppose them when they're overstepping. And Canadians have no tolerance, no tolerance for this. So it's going to be a difficult file. And the other aspect of this that I think is going to be very important, in particular for Carney, if he is elected, is going to be important for either of the major candidates if they're elected, because we are such an oil and gas dependent economy. But China is driving the most incredible and massive shift to renewable energy and the transition economy. And they are doing that at a staggering pace. And we are, within 10 or 15 years, going to be facing the impact of that new energy on our markets. And Mark Carney knows this file extremely well. Poilievre is going to try and say, well, you're just a climate sop and you're just all about shutting down the oil sands and shutting off Canadian interests. But there is going to be, in the coming years, no ignoring the new economy of renewable energy. And Carney knows it, and so does Poilievre.
He knows it as a investor from his experience with Brookfield, and he doesn't want to talk about it.
He knows it more from his role as the head of the Bank of England, because when the UK and China co-chaired the G20 in 2015, China made their move to renewable. This was the year also of the Paris Accords, and China made their transition to renewable energy and the concept of the world transitioning to clean energy a cornerstone of that G20. And the chief economist for the Chinese Central Bank and the Bank of England cooperated significantly on building the financial infrastructure that will support the transition. And Mark Carney then went on in the years following that to form a major association of private equity and fund managers that were agreeing to contribute significant resources and investment into the transition economy. So it's not just Brookfield Asset Management. The commitment goes much deeper and is far more sophisticated than that.
Fair enough, though we don't know about Brookfield, my understanding is, does have billions of dollars in various parts of energy, both green and fossil, and we don't have full information about when we're trying to determine which is the most significant attachment or familiarity with the file. We don't know to what extent his personal finances are bound up in this and in which direction. There's a level of disclosure that we're going to get after the election.
I do hope that journalists do start to inquire and inform themselves about not just the billions of Brookfield Asset Management, but the trillions of dollars that are going into the transition economy, the massive, massive investment. I mean, this is very minor. Brookfield is a small player in that whole thing, and Carney's own personal fortunes would be, I would assume that Brookfield also has holdings in the oil and gas sector as well.
My understanding is that they do. All of this is to say that the keyword Trump, when associated with Carney, has played very well for Carney, but words like China have been political liabilities and places where he's attacked by Polyev. Words like environmentalism and green energy are things he does not want to see next to his name in newspapers. And when it comes to trade, for these reasons, you know, headlines about his finances and his obligations and where he stands to benefit, he doesn't. That's not going to work out well for him. That's a point of attack for Polyev. Those are all things that a Canadian voter needs to know about where Mark Carney stands on them. When asked, here's what he told Fife and Chase over the Globe and Mail. Mark Carney rejects boosting trade ties with China, points to Europe. Is that credible? Is the next Prime Minister of Canada not going to boost trade ties with China?
Well, it's not just trade ties with China. It's trade ties with Asia generally. I'm sitting here on the west coast of Canada. Our ports, I think that the Port of Vancouver might be the largest port in Canada, and our shipping goes to Asia. It is a massive, massive market that Western Canadians know really well. The Indo-Pacific strategy is a key foreign relations issue for Canada.
And to be fair, he did say there are partners in Asia with whom we can build deeper ties, but the partners don't include China.
There are partners in Asia that we can build deeper ties, but the partners in Asia that share our values don't include China. There's certain activity that we could have with China. We obviously do have a large amount of trade with them, but we have to be very careful, very deliberate, and they need to meet Canadian standards.
It's interesting that South Korea and Japan just joined together for a tariff response with China for a tariff response to Trump. There is going to be no ignoring China. But yes, I guess people can say what they want to say in a campaign, but there's no credibly ignoring China. And Europe is a major market. It's a very mature market. And the other thing that I've gone into in detail in my Mortal Giants podcast is the importance of Mexico in all of this. And how I think that we're really undervaluing the strategic value and leverage of Mexico.
I feel like there are just like some domestic liabilities for Carney that are preventing us from having a robust conversation about the real issues that the next prime minister is going to have to address. And he's got to find a way around these minefields. The risk here is that the Liberal Party has not been great. Like, it's just so fuzzy. What is this future you're projecting? I can't get my head around it. And the track record is fuzzy because, you know, like, look at like Han Dong, who initially, Chinese interference, it seems pretty damn clear in getting him installed as the candidate. Then initially, he's a great man. We stand by him.
Han Dong is an outstanding member of our team. And suggestions that he is somehow not loyal to Canada should not be entertained.
And then he's like sidelined and like, oh, he's going to just kind of step down while he defends his name.
We fully accept that he is stepping away from the Liberal caucus in order to vigorously contest these allegations.
And then just the other day, we find out from Han Dong that under Mark Carney, they're not really interested in running Han Dong again.
Dong states his choice aims to give the Liberals the best chance to form a government.
So like, what are you saying? Were you infiltrated and you can't have Han Dong because you were compromised? Or like, what happened?
This is one of the things, Jesse, that I think is so, so difficult. There's the Chinese interference side to this. And the Liberals have not done a good job, and Trudeau did an especially bad job. And I really would like to see Mark Carney step forward and really make the case, the economic case, the national security case for getting into the transition economy, because it's huge. Electric power globally, renewable energy, comprise 30% of the world's electrification in the last year. China has now plateaued on their emissions because of their transition to this economy. This is not, oh, we're all going to freeze in the dark because we don't have oil and gas anymore. Renewable electric sources, wind and solar, are now cheaper. The new installation overwhelmingly that is happening around the world, and this includes India, the new installed electrified power is renewable by an overwhelming majority. The world is shifting to that, and there is money in it. There is value in it. There are jobs. Why Danielle Smith kneecapped the renewable energy wind and solar program, I think there were billions of dollars that were going to go into Alberta over that, which she kneecapped, that we are losing by the day the opportunity to participate in that economy, to profit from it, and to pivot a critical strategic resource, because we are going to see this transition. And I'm old enough now to know that 50 years will go by in a heartbeat, an absolute heartbeat, and we have to be ready for this. I would love to see Mark Carney make that case, which I thought Justin Trudeau did an absolute failure of it. So it bothers me to see this all get tied up with, well, if you're for green energy, then you're kind of, does this have to do with China infiltrating your political and political interference? There's something much bigger going on. And we have a strategic interest in putting this before the Canadian people, not as this soft, fuzzy, oh, just a carbon tax, you've got to axe the tax, this is against Canadian interests, but really to make an opportunity. Just go look at what's happening in Texas. Texas right now, which is the North American leader in installing solar and wind. And they're making billions and billions of dollars on it. So, like, we got to get into this game, and we need political leaders that can actually put this before the Canadian people, not as a we've got to stop everything and stop oil and gas and be against everything, but we have to move into the future. And sadly for Canada, sadly for our political world, the driver of that right now is China. So this is a complicated issue.
Sandy, we duly note stories that maybe could use more attention than they're getting. What do you have to duly note today?
Well, one of the things that I was noting was those prominent Yale academics, the author of the On Tyranny book and two other senior Yale academics that have now joined the University of Toronto. And I noticed also that This American Life was featuring the story of Ranjini Srinivasan, who is a doctoral student at Columbia, whose student visa was revoked and suspended as part of a fallout of the protests at Columbia, and she has fled to Canada. I have heard anecdotally of American physicians, more than one, who are making plans to move to Canada. And I'm just noting these stories and wondering, are we going to see an influx of scientists, academics, professionals? Like, I keep talking about how old I am. I'm old enough to remember the draft dodgers in the 60s that came and really had a huge impact on Canadian life and a huge impact on our culture. And I really wonder if we're about to see something. You know, the last time during the first Trump administration, people said that they were going to leave and then didn't. But I think that the kind of pressures that we're seeing on universities in the United States just now and other institutions, I think we might be on the cusp of something, and it could be a real opportunity. I just hope we can find a way to house people, or to receive them and find a good way to bring them into the fold if they come.
Yeah, I had a look at that too, and it's cool to think that Canada could be a place where the best and the brightest who are, I think, legitimately concerned about the growing tyranny in the United States might come here and bring up some really concerning things that I share concern about what's going on American campuses, where very clearly people are facing the full power of the state based on their exercising their freedom of speech. And I don't care about where you stand on these issues. That is anti-intellectual. It is an egregious violation of civil liberties, and it's a real scary warning sign, to the extent that we're hearing like that echoed in some of what the plans are for the Conservatives here in Canada. It's really concerning. So, duly noted. I want to duly note just the continued erosion of press rights in this country, and I just hate how the courts just don't seem to understand like what is necessary for a free press to function. This is a CBC story. Winnipeg journalist must hand over interview with father of man accused in mass shooting, according to this judge. So, City News reporter Morgan Mojeski must give city police access to the raw footage of an interview he did with the father of an alleged shooter. And the court said, well, it wasn't a confidential source, so therefore, this isn't going to be any problem for press freedom. once again, I feel like there's been like 40 times where this concept, I've explained it, you know, I don't know, everybody listening to the show must know it by now. The judge doesn't seem to understand it. And that concept is that if our raw materials are subject to police seizure that could be used against people in the courts, people won't talk to us. We just become an arm of law enforcement. And apparently this is just a completely symbolic thing. The lawyer for this journalist said that all of the information that's relevant to the case was aired, of course. If he had anything good, he'd put it in the broadcast. The police will be disappointed with the raw tape. It's just a precedent. It's just something that makes it impossible for me to say when I'm working out terms with a source and saying, well, what are you going to use? What are you not going to use? Why do you want to talk to me? I cannot say to them that this won't be used against them in court. I can't say that because I don't know that. I might be forced to hand that stuff over.
But hasn't that always been the case, Jesse? It's always been the law that you could be forced by a court order to hand things over. And generally speaking, as I understand, you express to sources that things can be off the record or they can be not for attribution or they can be entirely confidential sources, background only. There's all these different forms and status, but journalists do tell sources that if ordered by a court, I will be forced to hand this over. The question is, the live question, and we have a charter of rights that goes into this issue. No rights are absolute. There's always a balancing act that goes on. I hope that this case is appealed and an appellate court, a senior court, can take a look at this, shed some light on it. But I don't know that this is a real change from existing law. It's always been the case that the court could order you to hand over materials.
That is accurate, Counselor. But I will say in my defense that Sandy, dear listener, is of course a former Crown attorney who places me out of my depth with regularity. No, my understanding of this is that it's absolutely true that technically there is no absolute protection for sources in Canada. But what do y'all lawyers call it? Jurisprudence? Case law? Like, just like there's like trends?
Precedent.
I have been aware of an erosion of, in practice, because the courts do recognize, okay, if this had been a confidential source, I'd look at this differently. There's a spectrum of protection that the courts afford journalists when it comes to whether or not they're going to demand this stuff. It seems like they do understand that, like, it's meaningful when we force you to hand over your stuff, and you know, there are circumstances where we would be hesitant to do so.
It's like a search warrant. You have to go and get a court order that allows the intrusion into private materials.
So in an instance like this, I guess why I feel like this is worth duly noting is to document the increased frequency and the increased incursions, where it just seems like the court's respect for what we do and the parameters is eroding. So it's true. I would never, and I have never said, oh, don't worry, under no circumstance will this get out. But I used to be able to say, well, technically, it's possible that I would have to hand this over to a court, but that like almost never happens. That's how I used to put it. And I don't say that anymore with sources because I'm aware of these stories popping up. I haven't done any kind of data analysis of this, but like it seems like it's getting more normal that like, yeah, maybe you will have to hand it over.
It is a huge concern. And it's a huge concern for sources. I think this is going to be an increasing area of scrutiny and concern about protection. So duly noted.
Sandy, that is our show for today. Thank you for joining me. I can be emailed about today's show at jesse@canadaland.com. I read everything you send. You can also find me posting on Blue Sky. Sandy, where can people find you?
Best place is just to follow the Mortal Giants podcast. I am out of social media. I am gone.
Good for you. I can be reached at jesse@canadaland.com. I read everything that is sent to that email address, and I'm posting to Blue Sky. This episode was produced by James Nicholson, mixing and mastering by Caleb Thompson. Our director of audio is Max Collins. Our fact check is by Sam Connert. I am the editor and publisher of Canada Land. Our theme music is by So-Called Syndications by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca.
Ich bin Arndt Peltner von Radio Goethe. Ihr hört Mike mit Noise of Carpet right here on CJSF 90.1 FM and cjsf.ca. Hello, this is Arne Peltner, host of Radio Goethe. You're listening to Mike and his Noise of Carpet, celebrating the indie noises of the 90s on CJSF 90.1 FM and CJSF.ca.